Okay, so the series that we're going to be doing in three parts is going to be the story of Cain and Hevel, the story of the world's first murder. The lecture series that I'll be giving is, I'll say straight out from the beginning, is based on a work by Rabbi David Foreman. Rabbi Foreman has an institution called the, Hofburger?
Yeah.
Institute, where he lectures and teaches, and he has this book. Almost everything that I'm going to say is based on his presentation. I, of course, will present it in my own way, and I tinker a little bits here and there, but the basic information is all his. I'll give him all the credit from the beginning, but it's tedious if I quote him every time I say something, so I'm not going to quote him every time I say something, even though it's almost all based on his work and his lectures. The name of the book is The Beast That Crouches at the Door. It's a two-part book. The first part is the story of Adam and Chava in the Garden of Eden, which we did last year, and the second part of the book is the story of Cain and Hevel, the first murder, which we will do this year. Imagine little Bobby and little Debbie, two beautiful little twins, and Bobby and Debbie decide that for their mother's upcoming birthday, they are going to draw her pictures in honor of her birthday, and they're both going to present this wonderful birthday present to their mother of their artwork. And Debbie presents her picture first, and she presents really a beautiful picture. The color scheme that runs through the entire thing, and the beautiful scenery, and the waterfall, and a figure in the middle. And she says to her mother as she presents it, "Happy birthday, Mommy. I provided and drew this picture for you in your honor." And then Bobby presents his picture, and Bobby's picture is not quite as artistic as Debbie's. He doesn't quite have any color scheme that runs through it. A few stick figures in the middle. And when you compare it to Debbie's, it really just doesn't quite rate. Now, we all know, what is Mommy's response supposed to be as Bobby hands her his drawing and says, "Here, Mommy, I have also provided and drawn for you a picture for your birthday." That is so wonderful. Thank you, Bobby. Thank you. These are really beautiful. And if Bobby and Debbie, the two beautiful little twins, climb around and say, "No, but Mommy, which one do you like better?" Everybody knows that the correct response from Mommy is, "Oh, my beautiful children, I love them both in their own unique way, of course." And then you hurry them off to bed as you describe your great love for both of their presentations that they have given to you. We all know that. Everybody knows that. That's in the Parenting Book 101, which you don't even have to read to know that that's how you're supposed to respond. Which provides us with the opening question, which will frame the discussion of this story. This story of the world's first murder is going to be a complex story, which we're going to spend... it's going to be quick, because it took 4.5 hours on Shavuos, and then we're going to try to cram it into a little bit under four over these. So we'll move quickly. But it's a complex story, and there's a lot of aspects. And the obvious opening question that has to be addressed is, how do we understand Hashem's response to Cain and to Hevel? If we all know that the correct response is to lovingly accept both gifts, despite the fact that one is better than the other, how do we interpret Hashem's response? Does he not even know the most basic rule of parenting? What happens in our story that one is accepted in the face of the other, which is, as we'll see in the text, clearly an inferior type of offering? Hevel's, which was accepted, is a better offering. Cain, who brings his offering, is a less quality type offering, and it's rejected outright. If we continue in our Bobby and Debbie story, if a few moments later, Mom is walking down the hallway, and as she passes Bobby's room, Bobby's whimpering into his pillow, and he's crying, and he's all upset. What's Mommy's response supposed to be? She realizes what she did. She said to her son that she didn't want his thing. I got lost in my mushroom. I'm sorry. Let me go back one step. If instead Mommy receives the two things and says to Bobby, "Bobby, this is terrible. You call this a picture? These are stick figures. These aren't any type of figure at all. Where is the color scheme? The lines are all blurred. Everything is horrible." That we know is the inappropriate response, which is what we seem to have in the stories we have in the Chumash. If Mommy then finds Bobby whimpering in his room later, you realize, oh, I made a mistake. As human beings, made a mistake. I told Bobby I didn't like his picture. You're supposed to go in and you console the child. I'm sorry, it's a long day, I made a mistake. But what would it be if Mommy, walking past the room, sees Bobby whimpering in his pillow? She storms in and she says, Bobby, what are you crying for? Please. Bobby says, you didn't like my picture. You told me that it wasn't nice, and mommies aren't supposed to do those kinds of things. And Mommy says, grow up, Bobby. If you learn how to draw a little bit better, maybe I'll like your pictures a little bit better. At that point, we're calling social services. At that point, that's just unacceptable. That's not a response. And we're going to find that response. Cain, his offering is rejected, and he's upset. And God comes in and says, what are you upset for? If you bring something better, I'll be happy with you. But it doesn't seem like the way that we would expect the type of response given the circumstances. This is actually an entirely incorrect version of what happened. The presentation that I just told you of Bobby and Debbie is not at all what happens in our story. But it seems that way at first glance. And what we're going to do is, with that as a framework, go through this story and see in how many different ways and why that's actually not at all what took place, and therefore understand what it is and what it is that we have to therefore learn from that. That will be our opening. We'll refer back to this as we go through. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go through the story. Everybody has the sheets. We'll go through Psukim one at a time and see what it is that we have to derive from the story. Now, this is the beginning of chapter 4, as you have on the top of the page. The very end of chapter 3, the third parak in the Chumash, is the story of Gan Eden, the story of the Garden of Eden, in which we studied last year. After Adam and Eve both ate of the fruit, and they both received their respective punishments, and they were then exiled from Gan Eden, and that basically leads us exactly where we are right now. That's the context of where we've been immediately following the story of Gan Eden, immediately following their expulsion from the garden. We are introduced to this story. Pasuk Aleph. V'ho Adam yoda eschave ishto. Now the man had known his wife Eve, v'tahar v'teled es Kayin, and she conceived and bore Kayin. Kayin is, it's translated into English, we'll refer to him as Kayin. Vatoimer, saying, and she said, Konisi ish es Hashem. I have acquired a man with Hashem. Opening pasuk of our story, we are told man, Adam, had known his wife Eve. She conceives, and she gives birth to Cain. And she names him, Konisi ish es Hashem. Now in English, the translation is lost. I have acquired a man with Hashem. But in the Hebrew, the word for acquired is Konisi. I have acquired. Konisi, of course, comes from, or is from that, her statement of I have acquired a man with Hashem, is where Cain gets his name from. He's called Cain from the same root of to have been acquired. I acquired a man with Hashem, and therefore his name is Cain. Now, what strikes us in this pasuk is a number of things as we begin the story. Number one, that the man had known his wife Eve. That's based on Rashi's translation, which Rashi, just going through the grammatical rules of the Hebrew language, derived that the language v'ha adam yada means in the past tense. So that even though our story is taking place after the expulsion, chronologically speaking, if you are reading the Chumash, Adam and Eve are now out of the Garden of Eden. They have eaten from the fruit and they are now elsewhere. The actual pasuk that we're reading of the first union of man and wife, which conceive, in which she conceives and gives birth to a child, actually had happened before. He had known her prior to this. So he was actually born still in Gan Eden, still while they were in the Garden of Eden. Now, what's the first thing that jumps at you from this pasuk?
Hashem.
Meaning what? Good. Right, she acquired a man with Hashem. So the biggest thing that jumps at you're saying on the what you're touching on is the side part of the bigger picture, a tangential aspect of this is the very first human birth in history. How was Adam created? Right? God creates and takes the dust of all of the earth, puts together, blows into the nostrils the breath of life, and we have man. And how is Eve created? Right? God puts Adam to sleep, from his rib takes out a rib, and forms Eve. There had never been any other form of a human being having been created. I don't know this to be true, but it's possible if you would have asked Adam and Chava, how will you have children? How will the next generation come about? I don't know that. They might have said, I don't know, we're going to go to sleep one night and wake up in the morning and there'll be a child. Just like Adam, he went to sleep one night and there was Eve. Now maybe they knew biology and they knew it wasn't the way that it was made, but it had never happened before, that's for sure. So whether they expected it, let's assume they did expect it, but it was certainly the very first time in history. Now, the concept of birth is a miraculous event. That goes without saying. The concept of being able, from within, to create a child. That there was, out of, so to speak, nothing. And then within the body of the woman, to be able to give birth, to develop over this long period of time. And then, from the inside out, to create a child is beyond miraculous. No matter how many times it happens over the course of a day, you know, you go to a nurse and they'll tell you, oh, you have 24,000 births a day, or whatever their, a year, or whatever their number is. Each and every time, the concept of that is a fascinating connection with Hashem. And Eve states, Chava says, as Rashi quotes, why does she say, I've acquired a man with Hashem? When I was created, and when my husband was created, Hashem himself was the sole creative partner here. It was he alone did the entire work. With this, we are partners with him. Now, you pointed out, like, where's Adam? Well, it's not surprising that at this very first birth in humankind, that Chava, in the wondrous moment of the event, has sort of forgotten about Adam's role in this whole thing. That was whenever it was, and it's not part of the equation. Who does she feel she partnered with? Because she's been carrying this child. It's in her womb, the miraculous institution that has never been manipulated by science. Without a womb, we can do everything else in science, but you can't recreate a womb. You can't. If a child leaves too early, or there's a problem with the womb, there's just very little that science can do. That miraculous organ, she feels, who am I partnered with this? Who made this? Who gave me this ability to carry a child, develop a child, give birth to a child? In this moment, I've acquired a man with Hashem. And she feels partnered with him in this event. We don't necessarily find Adam as part of the equation, even though obviously he was. She feels partnered and connected with Hashem in this event. But she says something interesting. What word would we have used if she wanted to express that she has partnered with Hashem in creating this very first human being ever born? Okay, it's a fair question. Certainly, you know, in a simple reading, we would assume a child. The sages say that Adam was created as a grown man. And they have what to say about Cain and Hevel, that he was conceived and born on the same day, and that I believe they say he also was born a man, based on this verse. But that's in the Midrashic level. On the simple reading, we could assume that it was a regular child, but...
I think what you were asking, the word acquired is...
Wrong word. What should it have been?
I've created, Yotzarti, I formed, or Barasi, I've created.
That's what she should have said. That's actually the word that Rashi uses when he says, Kishibara Osi, when Hashem created me and my husband, he was alone, and now we're partners. Partners with him in what? In creating. And instead of saying we are partner, I'm now a partner with God in creating, she says, I've acquired a man with Hashem. Now this is a very important word, because Cain takes his name from this word. So it's not just that she used a different word and we just have to deal with it. Why does she use this and not that word? The essence of Cain, the essence of the character we're going to be studying, is represented by that word of acquired. Konisi is where he gets his name from. What does it mean that I've acquired a man? What's the difference between acquiring something and creating something? Those are the two options. She could have said, I created it, and instead she says, I've acquired it. Now, when you create something, you might take ownership or you might not take ownership of something. I can create it, I made this, and then I can make it free to whoever wants to use it, and it's open to the public. But what does it mean if, after I create something, I take ownership of it, and I copyright it, and I say, this is mine? What does it mean or represent when I take ownership?
You're responsible for it.
Correct. I'm responsible for it. When we say that I've acquired, it means that I'm limited. It's mine. And by definition, when I say it's mine, it's
yours.
Right. It's mine, and it's not yours. I've acquired this. Konisi ish es Hashem. I've acquired a man with Hashem. Means that this little boy, I have acquired him. I've taken ownership of it. It's mine. I have the rights to it, as opposed to anyone else out there. Now, what does it mean that she would say that? Now, she's not saying there is no one else that exists. It's Adam, and it's Chava, and now it's Cain. So there is nobody else. So she's not saying, like a three-year-old says, no, this is mine and not yours. She's saying something else when she says, I've acquired, as opposed to saying, I've created. As an example, let's say Bill Gates would develop a software. He wants to now put it out there in the market. He's going to copyright it, right? Why would somebody copyright something after they've made it? What's the primary reason they would do so?
So that no one else can.
And what would somebody do if they stole it?
Copy it,
and then they would make the money off of it. So the most obvious reason why, when I create something, that I copyright it, is to protect my financial investment in it, that nobody else can come and take it for themselves and benefit from my work. I want to be able to have it. But there's another reason. If Bill Gates, as I mentioned before, copyrights something, he doesn't need the money. Money's not an issue. But he's still going to copyright his software. Why would somebody copyright something and protect it, even if you're not concerned in any way, shape, or form with the financial ramifications of putting it out there?
Credit.
Credit. Possibility.
Ego.
Let's say there's a healthy type of ego. Somebody just said it. Pride. Pride. This is my baby. My job. I put everything that I have into this product. And as such, I don't want to just put it out there, because if I put it out there, what's going to happen to it? Someone else might come and misuse it and will ruin it. And a healthy sense of pride says, I need to maintain the rights to this, because I know how to use it best. I made it. It's mine. So when I use the word I acquired it, it's because I need to protect it from something, because I understand its value more than anything else. The woman brings an example, which is very applicable to what we're doing right here. When he wrote his book, so he put a lot of effort into exactly the way that he wrote it and the order that he presented the information, and then he puts it out there. What happens once he puts it out there? Little old me reads it, and I say, well, you know, I like this part, and I didn't really like that part, and I didn't find that argument so compelling, and you know what, I think the order would have been better like this. So I now take his stuff, and I now present it in my way, which is no longer the way that he would present it. Well, you can do that, because once you put it out there, now, do you have an option? I could either only teach it myself, or I could make it into a book and I could put it out there. But once it's out there, it's now out there. The word that I've acquired, what she's trying to get at is, this is mine, and there's a certain healthy pride in it of, this is what I did. I just gave birth to the first child in human history. This child that I'm holding, I acquired this child with Hashem. And she doesn't use the word to create. She uses the word that I've acquired. Konisi. I've partnered with Hashem, and I've done something that I take a healthy amount of pride in, that this is my handiwork. This is what I've done. I see the fulfillment of everything that I stand for in this child. Adam names Chava, Chava. Where does she get her name Chava from? Aim Kol Chai, the mother of all living beings, because from her is going to come every living being. And here she just started that process. She just gave birth to the very first human child, first person, and she says, Konisi, not just I created, but that I've acquired, I've taken an ownership, so to speak, that this is my child. And now she's not preserving the right that somebody can't take it and misuse it, but there's that sentiment of that I have an ownership, so to speak, a control, not again in a control that in an unhealthy way, but that this is something that I have done and I have made more than just that I've created, and she feels that she has partnered with Hashem in so doing. I'm going to just hold off on some questions. I need to make sure we get enough in. Okay, we're going to go back to this pasuk, but let's move on from that. Now, what's significant, one more thing actually on that pasuk, Kayin takes his name from this idea. Kayin takes his name from this concept of I've acquired with Hashem. To be konet, to acquire, to take hold and ownership of something. Let's move on. Pasuk Beis. And additionally, Vatoisef Laleda, she bore his brother Hevel. Hevel became a shepherd, and Kayin was a tiller of the ground. Here we are now introduced to the second brother. And right away, the word Kayin, as we've been translating, means to acquire something. What does Hevel mean?
Nothingness.
Nothingness. Like the breath that comes out of your air on a cold winter day. Hevel, Hovel, Hovelim, Hakol Hevel, Shlomo Melech. Everything is in vain. Everything is meaningless. Everything has no value. So Kayin, on the one hand, his name representing to acquire, to take possession of. And then additionally, she gives birth to his brother, Hevel. And then we're told their professions. We are told that Hevel became a shepherd, and Kayin was a tiller of the ground. Why does Hevel become a shepherd? People at that time were not allowed to even kill animals. The permission to kill an animal to eat does not happen until Noah and the flood. Why does Hevel become a shepherd? All that he can get out of the sheep or the flock, maybe their wool, milk. It's possible that if an animal died and you didn't kill it, you could eat its meat. It's unclear. Why does he become a shepherd? Not quite. So Rashi says a little bit differently. Rashi says, going back to the previous story of the Garden of Eden, what was one of the curses that Adam had to deal with after he eats from the fruits? The ground is cursed because of you. And now, it used to be that you could work the ground easily and it would produce its yield. But now, thorns and thistles will it produce. By the sweat of your brow will you eat your bread, because the ground is now cursed. And Hevel says, I don't want to deal with something which is cursed. I don't want to deal with that. So he goes off and he becomes a shepherd. But Kayin was a tiller of the ground. Kayin does engage that aspect of becoming a farmer. Now why should Kayin retain that? Even though Hevel rejects the working of the earth, Kayin is, he was a tiller of the ground. So on the simplest level, a utilitarian reason, you know, someone's got to earn a living, right? Someone's got to have what to eat. So he works the ground to be able to eat. But there's a far deeper connection between Kayin working the ground. Where does Kayin get his name from? Who gave him that name? His mother. What event caused Kayin's mother to give him that name? She gave birth. She partnered with Hashem in one of the most wondrous creative activities that exists in the world. She created another human being. And she says and exclaims, I have created a man with Hashem. And Kayin takes that name. Now, can Kayin recreate that which his mother did? No, he can't. He lacks the ability to do so. But what is the closest thing that Kayin, a man, can do to recreate the wondrous creative act of his mother? You plant and you grow. Now we, in the year 2010, in our industrial westernized world, really don't very much appreciate the wondrous miracle of farming. Because if you ask where do tomatoes come from, most of us respond,
Kroger.
From Kroger. Silly. Like, where else would they come from? But children, or public, sorry, equal opportunity advertising. But there's a wondrous act of planting. And it's a very similar idea, very, very similar when you break it down, the concept of taking a seed and you plant it in the ground. You say, well, what are you doing with that seed? You're ruining it. So you say, no, you just wait. You put it in the ground and you pour water over it, and someone would say, "What? Now you're drowning it? Just wait, and time, time. Now, what is man doing after he takes that seed and he puts it in the ground and he puts a little bit of water over it? What is he doing? Nothing but waiting. Nothing but waiting. Who is he partnering with as he does this? Similar to a woman who has a seed implanted within her, and then God takes over, and she partners with God as this child develops deep within her womb. Man takes the seed, puts it in the ground, waters it, and waits. And he waits, and he waits. And then, from out of the ground, this little green sprout comes out. And if you've been around a child who gets to see that, the first morning that they wake up and their little cup with the seed has sprouted, there is the most wondrous joy of awe. Look! And it truly is amazing. A little cup of dirt, and you put a little seed in, a little bit of water, and then life. Greenery. And then to be able to actually create fruit. Tomatoes, cucumbers, from out of the ground. I just put a little seed in. It's a wondrous act of creation. Not as wondrous as creating a human being, but it's on that same level, very, very similar. Cain, named from his mother's exclamation of, I have partnered with Hashem in creating this child, is a tiller of the ground. He partners with Hashem in the same way as his mother acquired a man with Hashem. Cain is a profession, does not become a shepherd. He's going to work the ground. Yes, the ground that has been cursed on behalf of his father's and mother's mistake, but that's the ground that he's going to work, because in that, he will also find that same partnership with Hashem that his mother found, and that his mother exclaimed with great joy, look at how I've partnered, and he becomes, as well, a tiller of the ground. Let's move on. Pasuk Gimel 3. Vayimiket Yomim. It was after a period of time, Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to Hashem. So far, the Torah told us very little about the characters of Cain and Hevel. First verse, we're told that his mother conceives and gives birth and names him Cain. Second verse tells us, and afterwards she has a second son who is named Hevel. And then we're told their professions. Hevel goes off and he becomes a shepherd. Cain goes off and he becomes a tiller of the ground. He works the ground, also producing in the way of his mother. And then the Torah tells us, after a period of time, Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to Hashem. How many other times has the Torah told us of offerings being brought to Hashem at this point in the Chumash?
None.
It's correct. This is the very first time that this has been done. Now, we are used to the concept of a karban, because we read for several months throughout the Sefer Vayikra all about various sacrifices. We're familiar with the concept in the Beis HaMikdash when the temple stood, there were offerings, so it's nothing new. This had not been done before. Now, there are midrashim that say that Adam might have offered a karban as well, but as far as the text of the Chumash goes, we do not have any other instance of a karban being brought other than this. Now, bringing a karban is a unique... Now, it's clearly passed the test of time, and it's been something which Hashem has accepted and enjoys. The reach, nicholach, the sweet aroma of the karban, of the offering, whatever it may be, is something of value. Now, it might seem simple, which it doesn't even really seem simple, but certain things, the first time it's been done, requires a certain amount of spiritual genius to come up with the idea. Cain has come up with the first sacrifice. He is Michadesh. He is a originator of an idea that he is going to bring. Now, why is it such a novel idea to think about a karban? Because what do you give to a God who doesn't need anything? What do you give to a God who has everything? So there's some concept which you figure, but you know what? This makes sense to do anyway. It makes sense. It's a value, and Cain goes ahead and for the very first time brings an offering. What response do you think Cain expected from this offering?
Gratitude,
happiness, something. Now, the Torah is not going to tell us anything about the response that he got. I don't know that Cain even expected that. He may have, he may not have, depending on what exactly his thought process was. How would he have known whether or not his sacrifice was accepted even? What does he bring an offering from?
From
Which makes sense, because what is Cain? He's a tiller of the ground, he's a farmer, so he brought from the fruits of the ground. Okay, let's go on. And then we'll get back to this. And Hevel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and from their choicest. Shem turned to Hevel and to his offering. So what do we see in this pasuk?
Favoritism.
Well, before we get to that.
A reaction.
Even before that.
Hevel thought it was a good idea.
Excellent, thank you. Right, the beginning of the pasuk is, well, Hevel sees Cain's idea. Who's the creator of this idea?
Cain.
It's clearly Cain. Hevel looks at it and says, well, that looks like a good idea. But then what does Hevel do different than Cain?
He brings
the choices. We don't have that phrase in the description of Cain's carbon. Cain's offering is of the fruits of the grounds. Whereas Hevel, when it's described, Hevel, he sees what Cain does, and he brings of the firstlings of his flock and from their choices. So he takes Cain's idea and improves upon it. Adds something to it. Not only is he going to bring this offering, but he's going to bring the best of what he has. And now we have the response. Shem turns to Hevel's offering. Now, what does it mean to turn to Hevel's offering? How did he favor him? So the Torah doesn't tell us what he did. Rashi fills in that a heavenly fire comes down and consumed the offering. Now, assuming that they understood that was a good thing and not a bad thing. If you've never seen that before, you might have thought that was a rejection. But they clearly understood that as an acceptance of their offering. So Cain walks up to, they must have had some type of altar that they built, and Cain brings of the first of his fruits, and he puts it down in a basket, and he steps back, and what happens?
Nothing.
Now, did he expect something to happen? Did he expect a heavenly fire to descend from heaven and consume his offering?
He probably expected more growth, you know, some kind of blessing.
Unclear. I don't know. It's the fruits are on the basket, they're sitting there on the rock. He probably stood away and said, "This is for you, creator of the world," and probably felt pretty good about himself, I would guess.
His way of showing appreciation.
Hevel comes forward and says, "Hell, that looks like a great idea." Hevel comes forward and brings now the choicest of what he has to offer. He is a shepherd, and he brings the choicest of his flock, puts it down on the rock next to Cain's, and poof! Fire descends and consumes it. Now how's Cain feeling?
Rejection.
Exactly. Exactly. But to verse 5, but to Cain and his offering he did not turn. This angered Cain exceedingly, and his countenance fell. So we are only really told that he did not turn to Cain after we're already told that he turned to Hevel. Hevel brought his first fruits, his flock, and a heavenly fire descends. Hashem turns to him and accepts it. But he did not turn to Cain. And Cain's response is real anger. Vayichar L'Kayin Me'od. The Hebrew in the verse 5. V'al-Kayin v'al-Min-Chaso lo-sho v'ayichar L'Kayin Me'od. Cain is exceedingly angry. Now, if we are in Cain's shoes, do we understand, explain, and justify this? Does it shock us that Cain is angry, or that fits? That's a fit. I came up with the idea. I am the genius here. I am the spiritual genius who came up with the idea of bringing an offering to the God who needs nothing, lacks nothing, but I am going to do so. And I do. And I feel pretty good about myself, and I step back. And I feel so good about myself that you copycat me. And you say, "That's a great idea, Cain." And then you one-up me, my little brother. One-ups me by bringing the choicest of his flock. And poof, his heavenly fire descends. And Cain is angry. He's exceedingly angry. Now, before we get to Hashem's response, which is going to be a very significant response to study, because here we have the very first exceedingly angry man in the world's history. And we would like to know, how does God respond to the very first exceedingly angry man in history? Because we probably have a lot to learn from that. But before we get to that, there's another massive question that we really need to introduce. Why was Cain's offering not accepted, and why was Hevel's offering accepted? Just based on the simple reading.
Because Hevel the choices he made in his special
right?
effort.
A simple reading. Hevel brings of his best. He brings of the choices of the firstlings of his flock. God apparently likes that. What did Cain bring?
Something.
Clearly not of the best. That's pretty clear in the text, as Rashi points out. But it's right there in the text. He brought of the fruits, whereas Hevel brings of the best, of the choicest of his fruits.
Just from the words, though, there does seem to be something personal, because it's not just, and to the gift of Hevel he did not turn, or he did turn. To Hevel and his gift he turned, to Cain and his gift.
Excellent, we'll get to that. That's a beautiful point. So the... that it doesn't just say that Hashem turned to the offerings and rejected the offerings of Cain, but that Hashem turned to Hevel and his offering, but to Cain and his offering he did not, so that there's a personal aspect of Hashem's response, not just to the actual things that are on the rock, but to the people who are bringing that. That's an excellent point, we will get to that. The question that we have to address is, what in the world was Cain thinking? What was going through his mind? That he created an idea. He originated the concept of, I will bring to the Creator. Right now the world is populated with my father and my mother and me. And my little brother Hevel. And I am going to bring an offering. And as I'm going through my tomatoes that are sitting there in the field, and I say, oh, this one's a real good one. I'm going to keep that one for myself. But this one, it's a little bit mushy, didn't really ripen. This is the one I'm going to give to God. What goes through the mind of someone who came up with the idea that I should give something to him and that it would make sense that which I should give is not of my best? It should be the middle of the ground.
We could say God isn't going to care because it's, you know, it's a tomato. He's not going to eat it on his lettuce sandwich. So
why are you giving it to him?
Why am I giving it to him?
Yeah. In other words...
because I want him to continue to give me bounty.
Okay, so we have to get to... in other words, you're right. In other words, there is a thought process of like, well, this is really good. I should keep it. So, but there is a sentiment of that you're getting past that when you give something to Hashem. I'm clearly giving him something. I want to take something of mine and give it. And it's an interesting thought process that Cain would come up with this idea. Develop the concept that it makes sense to do this. I should give of my stuff and give it to Hashem. And then he comes up with the idea that it's not going to be the best. Hevel then takes it to the next step and he gives of his best, and that's clearly accepted. So before we get to Hashem's response, let's work through this first step, because this is going to be the key step throughout the rest of the story. Where was Cain coming from that resulted in this type of sacrifice, so that we could then understand Hashem's response and then what takes place for the rest of the story? Now, the Foreman explains this as follows. It's, imagine yourself in the year 1879. You're in Menlo Park, New Jersey. You're a little glass blower. It's your profession. Didn't want to be a glass blower. You had big dreams, the Industrial Revolution, big things were happening around the country, and you wanted to be part of it. But Nebuch, what are you supposed to do? You got to provide for your family. You had a shop that your father had, and you're a glass blower. And meanwhile, days go by, months go by, years go by, and you yearn for something far larger than this. But you spend your day filling orders, blowing glass. One day, a gentleman walks in with a keen interest in your work. He looks at you as you blow your glass and as you encase it and asks you a couple of questions, thanks you very much, tips his hat and walks out. About a month later, so you head home late one night from the shop, you notice that the row of houses, all the houses are dark except for one. The end of the block seems to be something lit and it looks dangerous, as if someone left a candle burning and something might have caught fire. So you run down to the end of the block and you peek in the window and you see a gentleman hunched over and encased ember that seems to be burning. And just as you begin to catch a glimpse, it suddenly hisses and explodes in the person's face, and the house is plunged into darkness. And as you run back to your house, you can't get out of your head that the person who was hunched over that ember, that burning ember inside of a glass case, was the same gentleman who had been in your shop a month before. That night you're tossing and turning, you could tell something is going on over here. Eventually you can't take it. You throw over the covers, put on a robe, you run down the street, knock on the guy's door at 2 o'clock in the morning. Thomas Edison opens it up and says, "I'm so glad you're here. I've been waiting for you." Thomas Edison explains all of his plans. He takes out his map and all of his instructions of how he's had this idea that he's going to be able to encapsulate electricity, and in a light bulb he's going to be able to take a burning ember, which he calls a filament, and it's going to be able to burn, and no one's going to be subject to have to have candles anymore or sunlight. It's going to change the world, he says. But I have a problem. I don't know how to blow glass in a way that I can get a perfect vacuum, because if there's any air, he explains to you, that gets into this bulb, the ember catches fire and explodes. Do you know how to blow glass for me? Can you make me an encapsulated filament with a perfect vacuum? You get so caught. That's what I do. That's everything that I do. Of course I can do that. And you take his contraption back to your shop, and by 4 o'clock in the morning, you've blown a couple of perfectly fitted glass balls with absolutely no air. You run back to your shop, and by 5 a.m., with a flick of a switch, first light bulb is created. And you watch as the seconds turn to minutes, turn to hours, and it continues to burn and burn, and you can't believe you've just had a hand in history. A couple days later, you invite the entire community to his little makeshift garage, which has been fitted from top to bottom with light bulbs, and just as darkness settles, you invite everybody in, flip on the switch, and a thousand little suns are glowing in the room, and the room explodes into applause, and life will forever be different. And you've been part of it. And it's the most exciting thing, the fulfillment of your dreams. And it's a happy story, but there is a but. Where is the difficulty in this story? Excellent. The difficulty of this story is you have fulfilled your life's goal. You've been part of history. Who's a junior partner and who's the senior partner in this endeavor? It's like, well, let's figure it out. Edison came up with the idea, conceived of the concept, mapped out all the plans, figured out where the problems were going to be and how to fix them. And you're the glassblower who filled an order for a vacuum ball of glass. Pretty obvious. Edison is the senior partner, and you are the simple junior partner. When you're in a situation in which you see your life's goal fulfilled, and you are just a junior partner in that, therein lies the danger. A danger, a test for the one who has put his life's work into this, who sees his life's fulfillment. Because when you walk out of the corporate headquarters 3 years later, and as you peer back over your shoulder and the sign says, Edison and Foreman, or Edison and Freundlich Electric Works, you say to yourself, how come Edison's name has to be first? I mean, E comes before F, but still, where would he be without me? He would still be in his garage, exploding light bulbs, without being able to do it. If it would not be for me, this would never have happened. And it's a tricky thing to see your life's dream fulfilled, to see your mission in life fulfilled, and know and recognize your role in the endeavor at hand. That I'm just a junior partner. I'm the glassblower. And yes, I've had a portion of history, but it's a portion. I'm a footnote that none of you know whose name it is that I'm referring to, because it's just a footnote. Edison created the light bulb. The guy who blew the glass for him is lost in history. There's one other odd aspect of the first verse that we studied in the introduction of this pasuk. Chava, upon giving birth to Cain, first birth in history, miraculous event in which she says, I have partnered with Hashem, says that when she says that, uses an odd word. In the Hebrew, Vatomer, and she says, Kanisi ish es Hashem. I have acquired a man, es Hashem. What's the Hebrew word for with?
Im.
The word that she should have used would have been Kanisi ish im Hashem. I have acquired a man with Hashem. S, 9 out of 10 times, does not mean with. 9 out of 10 times, S is a word in Hebrew which is the word which connects a verb to a direct object. Bereshis bara, Bereishis bara Elokim, Es HaShamayim. Hashem created Shamayim. But we put the word S before that to attach the direct object, what it is that's being created, the world, the Shamayim, Es HaShamayim. Or Zarakti Es HaKador, you would say. I threw. So you don't just say in Hebrew, Zarakti HaKador, but the word S is inserted there. I threw the ball. The word S simply connects the direct object to my action of I threw S HaKador, the ball. Every once in a while, the word S does mean with, as it does here. This is not the only place in Tanakh. But when it's not, when the standard word is the word im, which means with, and you use the word S, one must scratch one's head and say, why would she have used the word S, which very rarely means with, and instead is usually the object, the connector to a direct object, when that's the a strange usage. So, as Rabbi Foreman explains, and I'll use an English example, to then we'll switch it to the Hebrew, in the English word with, we also have similar usages of the word with. I can say, I co-authored this book with my wife. Use the word with. How am I using the word with when I say, I co-authored this book with my wife? The word with is saying, I have partnered with her, and we together wrote this book. What if I used I said, I wrote this book with my typewriter, or with my word processor? Very different usage of the word with. I also wrote this book with my word processor, but that doesn't mean that we were equal partners and that we together endeavored in this activity. It means that was the tool that I used when I did what I wanted to do. I built my house with the help of a contractor. I built my house with a hammer and nails. One with, and English is just the same word with, and from context, we English speakers very seamlessly understand which usage of the word with we mean. Do we mean with, it's simply a tool of mine that I use to accomplish my goal, or I mean it was a partner of mine. I did this with so-and-so together. In Hebrew, the word im means with. I did this with that. If you use the word s, then it's that's the word that we usually use at the end of a direct object. I did this with something. There is a hint in Chava's declaration of her naming of Cain. Now remember, Chava is going to be going through, taking it back to our glassblower parable. She is now fulfilling her life's mission as the Aim Kol Chai, the mother of all living beings. And she's just done it. She's just given birth to the first human being. And she says, Konisi, a language of I've acquired. It's my, this is everything that I put myself into. Not just I created, but that this is mine. I own this in the sense of this healthy pride of what I've done. And she sneaks in the wrong word for with. Not that I have acquired with Hashem, as in sense of together as equal partners, but the word S puts Hashem on the wrong side of the direct object. It's as if she's saying, using Hashem as my tool, I have acquired a child. That's how the words translate, as opposed to, I have partnered with him, equal partners, or even where I'm the junior partner. But the words that are used translate as if it says, with Hashem's help, almost as if it's like with him being the tool, I have created this child.
So from her perspective, does she know any better? Because what she's seen, well, she doesn't actually see life created. Adam saw life created from him, so to speak. So maybe she doesn't even know how this whole thing works, in a sense. Like there's humans, and then all of a sudden, this is the first, conception of an actual child.
Right.
So maybe to her, that's how it,
It's fine. What Rabbi Foreman's pointing out in the word S is a hint at, in terms of junior, senior, equal partners,
right.
This is a word which implies I am doing this with that. Not with it, meaning like
so
as a tool with.
The perception of God is so different, maybe. Maybe she doesn't even see, maybe she does see God as a tool.
That would be fine. That's a problem, but that's fine. In other words, I'm not saying that it was wrong or right. I'm saying even if she is, it's a matter of where is the junior-senior partner in creating a child? Edison, the glass blower, a child has been created. Which one? God, woman. Which one is Edison and which one is the glass blower?
Well, we can see that because we've got, you know.
That's fine. All I'm saying that what he's always pointing out in her perception of it, yeah. It wasn't God is Edison, I am the glass blower, look at what I've done with Hashem.
So why did she have that perception?
So this, the, I mean, this
is dictated to Moshe by Hashem.
I understand. So, I'm saying this is what she said.
But Hashem dictates this to Moshe to write it down, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it must have been okay.
Why?
Why? Because Hashem told Moshe to write it
down. He told Moshe to write a lot of things. He told Moshe to write that he hit the rock. He told Moshe to write. I mean, we have lots of things. This that doesn't mean. I mean, the Chumash is filled with things that are not okay. I mean, it's okay that yes, everything in the Torah is not perfect. That's why it's there for us to learn from.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I'm happy to answer that. We can talk about that later, afterwards. This hint, which comes out, you know, it's like a start of something, that when she says, I've acquired Hashem, I know what we're going to trace now is man's partnering with God in creativity. Chava is the first to do so. She partners with Hashem in creating a child. And then there's the challenge of when I see this as the fulfillment, I'm the Eim Kol Chai. I am the mother of all living beings and I just did it. Konisi Ish Es Hashem. And I've acquired a man with Hashem. And what escapes her mouth is not that I've acquired on equal partnership, but the words that come out imply I have partnered using Hashem. I have partnered with Him to create this child. This, Rabbi Foreman suggests, will then fully manifest itself in the next generation, in Kayin, who takes that name that his mother gave him of Kanisi, to acquire, and bringing this first gift. Let's go back to Edison. You're the glass blower. 5 years have gone by, and you decide on the 5-year anniversary, it's time to give a gift to Mr. Edison, because after all, you've been partners, and you need to give. You need to give a gift. You suffer and struggle with this challenge as to who's really the boss here. You can have two approaches in terms of how you deal with Mr. Edison as you prepare to give this gift. Approach number one is overwhelming gratitude. The correct approach. Overwhelming sense of, I can't believe I was in the right place at the right time and you have allowed me to partner with you in changing world history. And I give a gift out of a sense of, I owe everything to you. The fact that I have this role in world history is all because of you, and I'm so grateful that you have given me this opportunity. That's approach number one you can have as you prepare to give a gift to Mr. Edison. Approach number two would be coming from not as healthy a place. It's coming from the approach that, after all, he really needs me. He would be nowhere without me. But deep down, if you're struggling with that train of thoughts, what do you really know to be the truth? What's your biggest fear? Well, what's your biggest fear as the glass blower as 5 years have gone by? Was it? Why doesn't he need you? Because he'll find somebody. I mean, after all, you're just a glass blower. And while you have the sense of, he could never do this without me, my fear is, well, find somebody else to do it for him. Because really, I know what my role is.
Well, the value hasn't been created. If he didn't in 5 years create enough value for himself as being more than a glass blower, but also like a consultant of
the glass. Okay, you're thinking it. Business model, okay? That's fair. So you're, so he's got this concern of the gift you're now giving is no longer coming from as much a place of a overwhelming sense of gratitude. Where is the gift coming from? It's really almost an insurance policy. I'm concerned that he will get rid of me in place of someone else. and I therefore need to give a gift to, you know, sort of keep the relationship going, to let him know that I appreciate what he's done and that he still needs me, that there's this great relationship, we've been partners. That's a very different type of gift. It's a very different type of gift. You can imagine a parent who has, a set of parents who have put their child through medical school. Son has gone through all the years of medical school, now he's 24, 25, and it's been years and years and years of investment in terms of all your resources and everything else to put the child through medical school. Now the son, who has now been through medical school, maybe a year or two of residency, gets engaged. And he and his kala come for their first Hanukkah for the chasana after all of these years, 2 years still to go of residency, and then further studies, and they come to your house for Hanukkah, and you see they've come as they're walking, and you see through the window as they're walking up to the door, they've come with a gift. And you, the parents, see the chasana and the kala have a gift in your hands, and you can imagine the moment. If when you open the gift, if you can perceive where it's coming from, you can perceive two places where this gift is coming from. What you're hoping for, what you're yearning for, your dreams are, that the gift says, Mom, Dad, I'm with my new beautiful kala. I would never be where I am without you. I'm gonna be the doctor, me. I'm going to be the one with the white coat, with the recognition, with my name published in all the journals. I'm going to change the world. I got big dreams. I'm going to find cures. It's going to be all me. And I know that I would be nowhere without you. You put me through medical school. You've been working and working and working to be able to afford this and to support me, to put me through this. And now I recognize, as I am on the cusp of fulfilling my dream, my goals, and I'm going to be huge, me, my name is going to be the one out there, but I would be nothing without you. Please, accept this gift as a token of my appreciation. That gift, Rabbi Foreman suggests, the type of gift you give the best that you have. Like, whatever I can afford, whatever I have nothing. Whatever I have, because what you're trying to express goes so much beyond whatever you can give, but it's coming from a recognition of, I am nothing without you, and you have put me in this place. But imagine you're a parent and you were able to perceive, as you unwrap the gift, a very different place. You perceived that the young chassan and kala recognize that they still have 3 years of residency plus 4 years in a subspecialty before he's going to start earning the bucks. And they're concerned that now as they're about to get married and start their world together, their life together, like, how are they going to make it? And the gift says, Mom, Dad, thanks for everything. I still need 6 years. And the gift is an insurance policy. We don't want you to think we haven't recognized what you've done. So we present this gift as a token, a sign, a symbol that we recognize it, but it's really got an ulterior motive. And that motive, if you can perceive it, is one of, we still need you, and I'm hoping this will buy you off. How do you accept that gift? Right? That is a rejection. That is the worst feeling as a parent. This is what it's about. All of those years of my resources, of my money, of my energy to put you in the place where you're in, and the way that you present a gift to me is in order that I should continue. That's what our relationship is about? That's it? If you could perceive that as a parent, the anger, the disappointment, the lack of relationship that that would engender, it would be far better to have never given a gift than to give a gift like that. Because that says something horrible. That says that this, you're just using me, you just need a couple more years, and this is going to buy me off? Don't you realize I'm your parent? Don't you know why I've done this? All I want to see is the gratitude that you appreciate it. I want you to go out there and be the one to do everything. I want you to be the doctor. I want you to be and create and change the world. Just say thanks. That gift hurts. That's a painful type of gift. If that's where the thought process of the child is coming from, when you give that type of gift, so as you're deciding what to buy, there's a calculation that goes on in your mind. Because you're not coming from a place of overwhelming gratitude. You're not coming from a place of, I am nothing without you. You have put me in this place. But you're coming from a place of, gosh, I really need to come up with something that's going to make them think that I still like them, but they still want to do it. There's a cheshbon, there's a calculation that comes in. You say to yourself, listen, we're just getting married, we don't have any money, we can't really afford the nicest thing. So what is it that we can afford, that we can give, that would get the message across well enough that we should get what we need out of it? That's the thought process that would go through someone's mind. You don't give the best of what you have because you're not coming from that place. Now, Reformant suggests this gift of Kain, who is the originator of this idea, the Mechadesh of a Karban, but he's a tiller of the field, and he, like his mother, was a partner with Hashem. Every tomato that came out of the ground, every cucumber, everything that grew, he partnered with God to creativity at its best. Just like Chava created a child, and he's creating out of the earth, and he's a partner with Hashem. But he's got a difficulty, he's got a test he's got to deal with. Junior partner, senior partner. I took the seeds and put it in the ground, and then God does the rest. Am I Edison, or am I a glass blower? When he decides to give a gift, the calculation of giving a gift that's not of the best, that's not the top, that's not coming from there, means it's not coming from a place of everything that I have, my whole life's work, my name Kain, to acquire, to produce, to create. I'm nothing with you're doing this. I'm your tool in being able to create this. But that test is a difficult test to pass. When you give a gift that's coming from there comes from a place of I give the best of whatever I have because I'm just so overwhelmed with the fact that everything that I have comes from you. But when you're not coming from that place and there's a calculation, then you come to the conclusion of, well, this is a really good tomato. I shouldn't give this because really I need this tomato more than he needs it. Yeah. So you come to a calculation. What type of gift makes sense to give that says, I recognize that you're the source of all this and I really need you to continue? Okay. So it's not the best. You have some mushy tomatoes because the best you keep for yourself because of your calculation of I this is my stuff. I made this, and if I'm not coming from a place of overwhelming gratitude, you end up with that type of gift. How does Hashem respond to that type of karban? Not interested. You're buying me off? This is a religious insurance policy? That you're afraid that somehow our partnership is going to end and I'll find somebody else? Or that I won't continue to do this? So the type of sacrifice that you give is mediocre because you're just trying to buy me off? That type of sacrifice is not accepted. It's not acceptable. It's as if Hashem is saying, that's what our relationship is about? That's not what it's about. I'm not interested. But it's not a Debbie and Bobby type of comparison. It's not that hers was so much better and yours is so much worse. It's that you, alone, by yourself, without anyone else to compare it to, said to me in the type of sacrifice you're bringing, that you're just trying to buy me off. You're just trying to present something to say, we need this relationship to continue. But it's not coming from a place of overwhelming gratitude. It's coming with a calculation of, what can I afford to give? What makes sense to give? I need to keep some good stuff for myself. I'll give some to you. And that alone is rejected, because that's not the relationship that Hashem desires. Okay, I'm going to leave it here, and we'll pick up next week with Hashem's actual response. This takes us up to the point of where Hashem is going to be coming from in terms of what Kain has done, in terms of his understanding of who he was, following the path of his mother of Kanisi Esh in the same way as she saw the beginnings of the wrong side of the partnership, in which Kain sees himself as part of the creative partnership, but too much himself and not enough of Hashem, so that he's not coming from a position of, I am nothing without you. You have provided me with everything that I need, so with my overwhelming sense of gratitude, I give you everything that I have. But there's this imbalance of what role we have, the glass blower problem of trying to understand what role you actually have, and in that place, you can come up with such a type of sacrifice, such a type of carbon, which he does, which is utterly rejected. And what we'll pick up with is, but Kain is angry. Kain, nonetheless, is angry. Because you can imagine, in the same way as if there are Farchosin and Kala come to their parents' house, and the parent sees the gift and was able to perceive why it was coming from, and they throw it out in front of the child's going to be angry.
He's going to be miserable. Why should he be angry?
because his was rejected and his little brother's was accepted. We're going to have to see Hashem's response to that, which we will see next week. Okay, so I'll call it here. Anyone else leaving, leave. If anyone wants to say questions, I'm happy to take some questions. Did you want to make any announcement? Or? Yeah. For naming him kind, I don't think so. Not my mind. Not my understanding of it. Actually, so there's a lot of talk, which I didn't want to get into because I thought it would just distract from the conversation. It's unclear who names Hevel. It's almost as if he just was Hevel. Nothing like it. He's not even given a name by anybody. There's a discussion also whether or not he was a twin or not. Because the Torah does not say, in Pasuk Aleph, it says, Vatahar, Yodo Eschava, that man knew his wife, Vatahar, and she conceived and gave birth. And it doesn't say that again in Pasuk, just Vatose Veledes, and she then additionally bore his brother Hevel. So there are Mefarshim who learned that he was actually a younger twin. Tosus explicitly says not that way. Tosus in Sanhedrin learns that Cain was born in Gan Eden and Hevel was born after the expulsion, that they were not twins. But there's discussion as far as that goes also.
So attitude mattered from the very beginning.
Yeah, 100%.
That's the biggest.
Did Cain see Hevel as nothingness?
Attitude.
Is that what
you say? I don't know.
You know, that's just more reason to treat your brother poorly. Just, he's nothing. Why should he do better than me?
I don't know.
Doesn't it bother anyone? I mean, I would think there'd be a little mention of God.
He did play something.
Abe Riff and his wife. That's my kind of
scene.
Probably. I have a question. If the Yetzirah of like Chava and Kayan was to take Hashem out of the picture or to, you know, minimize Hashem's role, it seems to me, and I'm not, you know, challenging Rabbi Forman, obviously, but the fact even needing an insurance policy is a certain recognition of your own frailty and dependence.
100%.
And
yes,
it seems like there is amount of, even if it's not for completely pure reasons, it's like, you know, Hashem, because I recently gave a present like this to my parents, knowing that I was going to ask for a favor later. But it was recognizing that I really needed that favor.
That's exactly right. In other words, same example, the child recognizes that he needs his parent, that his parent has put him in the place that he's in, and that he owes everything. But it's hard we know that, but what we struggle with is, but it's still me. I'm the one who went through medical school.
Yeah.
I'm the one who put in all the hours studying, and I'm the one who...
It's about me.
I know both, and then in terms of how we express that is the issue. In other words, an expression of, I recognize that gift. It's a very powerful example of the type of gift we give, that one that says, I really recognize that I would be nothing without you. And yes, I know that I'm going to be the one who will be the big doctor, and I'm the one who put in all the hours, but I would never be here without you. It's a very different place than when you get yourself in the way, and it's just, I still need you, but I'm not fully recognizing in my expression of thanks how much you've played a role in that. But I do recognize
and
both, yes.
And thing.
So that the way that it, from the fact that he then takes that up and he says you can't give them that, you have to give them the best, would come from that perspective. He's in this approach. There are many approaches to the story. This is just one. You can argue and disagree because there's no one unified approach to the kind of hell. It's a very big.
My next thought was, Hashem, understands that he wasn't perfect.
Yeah, well, next week we'll see his response. In other words, his response isn't, oh, you brought me the sacrifice, you're dead. It's not a response. He talks to him. He's going to have a response in terms of what he then needs from Cain to do from here on out. And we will see that.
You know, we inherit that quality. We don't have a natural gravity into, but we have to learn that.
That is man's job in this world, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good. I again, We did not address every single question. That's a fair question. I didn't really see very many people spoke about that exactly in terms of what period of, like, what took place that he suddenly decided to bring this carbon. But there was a certain period of time that went by when it occurred to him. See, a little bit it fits with this approach in the sense of, well, we've been doing this for a while. Well, now I need to somehow acknowledge that we've had this partnership and we needed to continue. So it wasn't like an immediate, it's sort of, within this approach, it lends itself to the sense of, because we've been partnering through the creativity out of the ground, after a period of time, then I realized I need to, you know, it wasn't a sacrifice out of, I've been created, I need to give something. It's like, look at what we've been doing, I now need to recognize that and give a gift. So it fit a little bit with that project. That it was after all of the years of harvesting, right now I need to somehow express something towards that.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.